advocate's immunity. A lot of lawyers make their money suing professionals like doctors and financial advisors when they make mistakes. But did you know that you cannot sue your lawyer if your lawyer stuffs up your court case? Well, last week, the High Court of Australia somewhat narrowed this so-called advocate's immunity. Associate Professor Kay Lockland, based at Bond University Law School, welcomes the High Court's decision, which involved a New South Wales resident, David Kendirjian.
Advocate's immunity is a protection that barristers and solicitors have from actions against them for negligence by their clients. So if a client is dissatisfied, they can't sue a lawyer only for work that's been done in court or work that's done in preparation for a court case that's intimately connected with the way the case is conducted in court.
So if a barrister or a solicitor gives, say, dodgy advice on a contract or stuffs up a conveyancing, they can be sued.
They can be sued for commercial advice and for work that's unrelated to courts. And even some work that's related to a piece of litigation but isn't intimately connected with the way the case is going to be conducted in court.
For instance, if you're running a trial, you can't be sued if you're cross-examining a witness and you stuff up a question or you don't ask a question that you should have. That's in the course of a trial. You can't be sued for that kind of thing.
Yes, you're protected for that. So asking the wrong questions or neglecting to call a witness. And then because that decision to call a witness or not might take place before the trial, that's probably intimately connected.
Now, who is Mr. David Kendirjian? He's tried to push the envelope in this regard. Who is he?
Mr. Kendirjian was a litigant who was involved in a car accident. He was injured. He began an action with a solicitor. The driver of the other vehicle admitted liability. So she admitted that it was her fault. But the issue of how much he should be awarded for his damages was scheduled to go on before the District Court in New South Wales. Now, they then engaged a barrister as well. So Mr. Kendirjian had a solicitor and a barrister. On the first day of the hearing, and this is quite common in litigation, they talk about settlement. The defendant, through her lawyer, to his lawyers, offered to settle by paying $600,000 and legal costs. Now, Kendirjian said that his lawyers never told him how much was offered, just that an offer had been made that was too low. And he says they rejected it without his instructions. Then the hearing proceeded and he was awarded about $300,000.
Oh, less than half the settlement offer.
Yes, well, slightly more than half with the, you know, the little bits and bobs. An appeal against that assessment was unsuccessful. So he was stuck with an award of just over half what had been offered.
Now, years later, David Kendirjian commences a legal action against his barrister and his solicitor in negligence. And it's around the rejection of that settlement offer. What's
Yes.
the thrust of his legal argument?
Well, it was only about 3 years after the initial lack of advice. He says it's only then that he discovered how much better the offer had been. And so he wanted to recover the difference. The trial judge dismissed the case on the basis of advocate's immunity and the New South Wales Court of Appeal agreed. So he went on to the High Court, and surprisingly, the High Court allowed his appeal, saying that this advocate's immunity did not protect his lawyers in this circumstance.
So what, that opens the door for him to go back and argue before a court whether or not, in fact, they were or they weren't negligent?
Yes. So his claim can now go to trial in the district court against his lawyers. He still may not succeed. He has to prove that they were negligent in either not advising him or advising him to reject the $600,000 offer.
So, Kay Lockland, what did the High Court of Australia last week have to say about advocate's immunity?
Well, they determined last week, and they confirmed a decision they'd made a year earlier, that the immunity does still exist. They're not going to reopen it. But they clarified the scope of the immunity in relation to these settlement situations. The case last week and the previous case, they've decided that poor advice to not settle and advice that's bad about settling can both be sued for.
So that kind of advice or legal action is not intimately tied with the court case?
Well, there are two judges in the High Court in both of these cases who clearly think it is intimately tied. They've basically accepted what the majority judges said in the previous case, so they've agreed that this case also, the one a week ago also, should be able to proceed. But so you've got a majority of judges who say that there isn't an intimate connection. There needs to be a functional connection between what the advocate does and the way the court determines the case. And that connection doesn't exist when you're talking about settlement. There's, in a sense, an historical connection. If you advise not to settle, then, of course, the case goes to trial. But that's not a functional connection with the way the case will be determined at the trial.
What can and what can't be looked at? I'm thinking, you know, Mr. Kendirjian didn't do well at trial. Do they look back in this negligence action, if it goes ahead, do they look at why he didn't do well at trial, or just what happened at the time of the advice being given or not given as to the settlement?
Well, the reason the majority allowed this to go ahead, this claim of negligence, is because of the, as they say, a functional disconnect. They argue, or they say, that there cannot be a re-examination of what the trial judge determined. The only question that will be live is whether the lawyers, at the time they advised the client not to take the offer or rejected it on his behalf without proper instructions, at that time, were they careless in making that decision? Now, in a sense, there's, again, you look to the judgment, and the Mr. Kendirjian is saying, the judgment amount is this much, I could have got this much, the difference is my damages. But in order to determine whether the lawyers were careless, you don't look at how the judge arrived at his figure, you just accept it as a number.
Do we know why he didn't do so well at trial?
Well, the interesting thing, and the thing that greatly concerned the two judges who dissented, I think, was that one of the reasons the trial judge gave him such a low number was because his credibility was impugned. The judge was not impressed with his testimony and believed that he was exaggerating his claims. So you can understand the lawyers, perhaps in their defence, might say he exaggerated his claims, he was found not credible, therefore you can't get us for negligence in our advice. But in fact, they're not allowed to say this is what the judge said about his credibility, because the question of their carelessness will be determined at the time they rejected the offer. So they may win the claim by Kendirjian for damages on the basis that he had us convinced that the damages were going to be really bad because his injuries were so bad. So the fact that, you know, he was not credible at trial then led to reduction in damages, but they were advising him on the basis of what he said. I'm purely speculating about that.
Mm.
But they can only argue about the basis on which they made their decision and gave their advice at the time they gave it.
Now, supporters of advocates' immunity say, look, we need to have finality in court cases. We can't, years and years after an event, open up a Pandora's box and go back and revisit what happened or what didn't happen in litigation. What's your view?
Well, I appreciate the court's concerns that you don't want to bring the court system into disrepute by having a separate civil action that says you get some damages because that decision was wrong. And that's why in this case the High Court judges were careful to say you can't say that decision was wrong. You can say your lawyers got it wrong, because that was the ultimate decision and it was clearly different. It seems a fine distinction. And the concern of the minority judges and probably barristers everywhere is that the defendant, the lawyers, may want to say our advice was good, the judge got it wrong in his assessment of your credibility, so it wasn't us that caused your loss. That's the major concern that the courts have that justifies the retention of the immunity of advocates. We don't want, in a separate civil case with different evidence, different standards of proof potentially, an attack on a decision of a court. The court system is self-correcting. It has an appeal structure. Now, of course, Kendirjian in this case did appeal, and his appeal was unsuccessful. Now he's accepting the judgment of the court, but he's saying, well, my lawyers should have advised me to take the $600,000. They should have anticipated that I was going to get a lower judgment. And he may or may not be successful in that.
How important is this decision?
It's very important because it may well be perceived, and I think it is, a weakening of the immunity. Now, the concept of the advocate's immunity has been strongly supported by the High Court over the last 30, 40 years. But the scope of it has always been unclear because there's not a lot of cases to tease out that scope. And this case opens up, I think, areas where barristers probably thought they were protected.
Does this concept of advocate's immunity, does it exist in all the equivalent jurisdictions around the world, or is Australia a bit of an outlier?
Australia is probably a bit of an outlier now. We followed the United Kingdom decisions to adopt and uphold this immunity, and yet that was abolished, the immunity was abolished in the UK in 2000. Justice Kirby, I think, in Daughter Ekenaika, an earlier case, said it never existed in the United States. It never existed for other than Crown prosecutors in Canada. It does not exist in most countries of the world. It's just a feature of England. Even they've reduced it, and New Zealand, even they've reduced it. All that leaves is Ireland and Australia and Norfolk Island. So it may still have scope in other parts of the common law world, but there's every chance that if it's reopened in those existing countries that haven't addressed it, that they may follow the English approach and abolish it anyway.
So in places like England, like Canada, New Zealand, some of them never had it, but when they've rolled back advocates' immunity, have we seen a flood of cases where advocates have been sued by disgruntled clients when they don't get a result or an outcome that they'd hoped for in a court case?
No, there's been no floodgates. New Zealand and England have taken the robust approach and said, look, it's not appropriate in the modern context.
Well, finally, Kay Lachlan, what do you think? This decision of the High Court is a good one?
I think it's a good decision. I just wish they'd gone further and overturned the immunity completely.
Associate Professor Kay Lachlan from Bond University, thank you so much for speaking to the Law Report.
Thank you for the opportunity.
And I did approach both the New South Wales Bar Association and the Australian Bar Association seeking an interview for their views about advocates' immunity and this decision, but they both declined the offer. You're listening to The Law Report on radio or perhaps via a podcast, which is available both from the RN website and from iTunes.